is a recording of an interview with Mr. Robert D. Kennedy in his office at Union Carbide in Danbury, Connecticut, on February 4, 1997. The interview is by James G. Trainum. Kennedy, I know from what I've read that you were born November 8, 1932, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Can you tell me something about your parents and your childhood?
Well, Pittsburgh was my hometown, and we grew up there off and on. My father worked in a family business, but unusually, he also had a professional singing career. And when the singing business was good, we lived in New York, and he was on network radio and did a lot of concert work. When the singing business wasn't so good, we were back in Pittsburgh in the coal and lumber and builder supply. I grew up in a routine way in Pittsburgh and then went off to Cornell.
Let me ask you something about your pre-college days in Pittsburgh. You went from the public schools there?
I went to public schools for a while, and then for my last 3 years in high school, I went to a small boarding school up in New Hampshire called the New Hampton School. And all of my brothers had preceded me there. I think we were indifferent students in high school and public school in Pittsburgh, and the family sent us away to give us a little bit better discipline in academic work.
And it worked.
It worked pretty well. Of course, my older brothers were caught up in the Second World War, and they had sort of interrupted educations. But we all finished university. I was the only engineer. I was the youngest of four boys.
When did you have your interest in engineering to develop?
It was a kind of reluctant interest. I actually wanted to go into writing and journalism, but the family persuaded me. I had pretty good grades. I was sort of an honor roll student through high school, and the family persuaded me that one of us might ought to try engineering, and it would be a better background for whatever career I might choose. So I did. I went to Cornell, and the first couple of years were pretty tough for me. I was in mechanical engineering, and then my father died, and I had to get pretty serious. The last 3 years were better. I was in a 5-year bachelor program, and the school did an enormous amount for me. Cornell did.
While you were there, did you ever have any chemistry courses?
In that 5-year program, we were required to take, everybody was required to take a general chemistry course, and then we took organic chemistry and phys chem, and I think that was all of the chemical exposure I had. We had a lot of metallurgical work, too. Materials and metallurgical and cooling curves and all that kind of stuff. Also thermodynamics, I guess.
Did you go straight through Cornell in the 5-year program, or were you in kind of a co-op program?
No, I worked right through for 5 years, and after my father died, it was all supplemented by grants from the university and loans and summer jobs, but my summer jobs were on construction and hard labor.
Well, when you graduated in 1955 from Cornell with your bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, what was your employment choices?
Well, times were pretty good for in the mid-50s coming out of a school like Cornell, and there were really a lot of choices. I think I probably had 4 or 5 job offers, with companies involved in some kind of industrial manufacturing or in the oil industry. Union Carbide was a company about whom I knew very little, but I was very, very impressed with the people I talked with. Maybe this is the way it is with young people. When you read about corporations and annual reports at that age, it doesn't mean a hell of a lot to you, and I think you go more on gut feel and instinct. And Carbide offered me a job in a part of their business which served the metals industries, and I had been particularly interested in the metallurgical engineering courses that I took at Cornell. I did well in them, and I liked it. Maybe growing up in Pittsburgh, I was kind of a hot metal guy, and so I started with the carbon products division of Union Carbide, which made graphite electrodes for melting steel in electric arc furnaces, carbon blocks, huge big carbon blocks for lining blast furnaces, and nuclear graphite for the whole nuclear program, which was pretty big in the 50s, reactor graphite, that kind of thing.
When did you decide that you were interested in management?
I don't know that I ever make a conscious decision. I was always kind of in management. I was a class officer most of the way through high school, and then in the university I was president of the fraternity house and an officer of the interfraternity council, and I just sort of gravitated toward it. I sort of liked organizing things, and it happened, and I enjoyed it, and then I'm sure that the people who were my role models when I was a kid, the ones you looked up to, were either sort of the campus leaders or athletes or some combination of the two, and or athletic leaders, and so those were my heroes, and those were the people I wanted to be like.
During your years with Carbide, you've been associated with the chemical part of Carbide for most of the time, I believe. What has been your experience with innovation in chemistry during that time?
Well, it's been the kind of love affair that the neophyte and the uneducated has with any art or discipline, which you can admire a lot, even if you're not a great practitioner. And Carbide was such a conglomerate. I spent my first 20 years in the mining and metals and metal industry related part of Carbide. This was in carbon, and then in ferroalloys, and then a little bit later in gases. Carbide had a very big business in industrial gases, the air separation business, oxygen, nitrogen, argon, and which really is all chemistry, but it's not polymer chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until the early 1980s that I had been kind of a group executive over on the alloys, gases, carbon side of Carbide, and I was asked to move over into the head of the whole basic petrochemical business of Union Carbide, and this was, you know, basic C1 chemistry. And so that's my education in ethylene-based chemistry really started in earnest in the 1980s. I had this experience, though, for some crazy reason, one of the bounces that the ball takes in life. When I first started in training in 1955, the fellow who was the kind of vice president of marketing, and I was joined in the marketing and sales organization, had the idea that it would be a good idea to put a trainee out in the research laboratory of of the carbon business. It was out in Edgewater, near Cleveland, Ohio. And so I spent about 4 months in the research laboratory as a research assistant to a very serious research chemist. And at that time, that part of Union Carbide had deliberately hired in a lot of very fine scientific people who had come from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Carbide had the contract responsibility to, under the government to run Oak Ridge and Paducah, Kentucky, and they had some fantastic scientists down there, all PhD chemists, and the carbon folks went after them because they were interested in really getting into basic carbon chemistry, and it was high temperature research work for synthetic graphite and duplicates of synthetic graphite, as for example boron nitride. It was a nuclear graphite, ultra pure graphite for the nuclear reactor program, and even the combination of graphite with uranium and uranium carbide as a fuel element for it. And so, and they would have, they had for all of the scientists there at the research lab, they had seminars every Friday, and three or four guys would get up and give papers, and they'd have discussion of them. And I, as a trainee, I was allowed to go and sit in on those. And I had such an enormous admiration. I don't know, I just loved to go in the cafeteria and sit with those folks and listen to what they talked about. And I also began to think that the management of the organization and management of scientific people is maybe one of the most difficult jobs in corporate management. That is, how to harness these brilliant people in a constructive way, and yet not crimp their innovative instincts. And the question being largely, how far do you let inventors and innovators and basic researchers go down a path before you say, well, that doesn't look like it's going to be commercial in any near time frame. Can't we focus a little bit more on things related to our business? And so I still think that that is an incredible challenge both for management and for industry in general.
What was your experience with scientific teamwork in that period?
Well, probably, I guess I'd follow two answers to that. The kind of teamwork and collaboration that that goes on between teams of scientists themselves, I think is very much highly dependent on the personalities and the intellect of the individuals. I think explorers in the scientific area and researchers can be very prickly about their work. And very proud as they should be about their own proprietary work. That is their lifeblood. I think it's hard to force that between research individuals who just don't hit it off or don't make the intellectual connection or don't value the particular contribution that each can make. On the other hand, the sort of teamwork that takes place between the research bench and the outside world, between research, let's say, and manufacturing, or process technology, or design engineering, or even product development in the marketplace, that can be a very useful collaboration because there's generally more willingness to recognize the limitation of one's own expertise and say, well, you know, I really don't know a lot about how to translate this and scale it up into economic commercial grade, commercial size project. Or I do realize that there's a market out there and customers out there, and just turning out my invention in the form that it's in may not be the form that is most acceptable to the marketplace. So yeah, I'll work with those market development people and the customer people even, because I realize that they're probably not as superior a being as I am intellectually, but they have a point of view and they pay the bills.
Tell me something about your experiences in company management. I believe you were overseas for a while.
Yes, I actually started with an international assignment rather early in my career. I was still based in New York, but I was coordinating business and market development operations worldwide, starting about 10, 12 years after I came with the company, and I loved it. I just thought it was fascinating to explore markets in other parts of the world, different cultures, different ways of doing things. We had a lot of manufacturing overseas, and I gained an appreciation for the problems of migrating technology and know-how around the world, sort of coordinating so that you could. If you had a customer in Turkey, this is a real example. We could have supplied that customer in Turkey from any one of five different plants of Union Carbide, and left to their own devices. Those were all different country companies. They would have quoted five different prices and five different qualities at least, and so someone had to coordinate that. So to the marketplace, we looked like rational people, and I enjoyed that experience enormously.
Where were you based overseas?
Well, at first in New York, traveling the world. I remember my first year, I was out of the country about 20 weekends. After that, we moved to Switzerland, which was our European headquarters for Union Carbide in Geneva.
How long were you in Geneva?
Six, almost 7 years.
Did you develop a facility with French language during that time?
I was okay. I'd had a lot of French in high school, and it stood me in good stead. I gave some speeches in French, and I had trouble with the verb forms, but that was all.
Apparently, you communicated satisfactorily.
It worked okay, yeah.
After the nearly 7 years in Geneva, you returned to New York?
I came back to the States, and I was sort of parachuted back in as a head of the industrial gases division of Union Carbide, which was called Linde at that time, now Praxair.
So that was a shift from your metallurgical.
That moved me out of the carbon ferroalloys mining area into gases, and it was about a $2.5 billion business. It's about a $4.5 billion business today, but it was still dealing with an area that I was pretty comfortable with, and that is. The steel industry, big air separation plants to provide oxygen for basic oxygen furnaces, and argon for specialty steels and stainless steel processing, all the welding and steel and metal working applications. Nitrogen for a big nitrogen demand in the chemical industry. This started to push me more toward chemicals, both oxygen and nitrogen in the chemical industry, and nitrogen in food freezing applications, electronic specialty gases for electronics, work. And so that and that's a very solid and good growth business worldwide.
From there, you moved into other management positions, I believe.
Well, then I kind of got a group job overseeing gases and nuclear for a while. Oak Ridge came under me, and some of our area companies, Canada and all of Latin America, for all products. And then I moved over to petrochemicals in the early 80s, which was about 25 years after I'd started with the company and 16 years before I retired.
What particular changes in management or management style have you taken note of during your career with Union Carbide?
Well, Carbide was, from its inception, when Carbide was put together in 1917, it was put together as a conglomerate of businesses. The original businesses were the calcium carbide business. That was the original Union Carbide. Made calcium carbide in a smelting process, which was then used to generate acetylene gas. The Linde Air Products company, which was the first in this country to commercially separate air and provide oxygen for at that time mostly metallurgical processes and welding and so forth. And the old carbon business, which was the oldest business of carbide, its inception was in 1886. And their first products were making carbon arc for electric street lamp lighting, and little carbon electrodes that were the center of dry cell batteries, and that's what spawned the Eveready battery business. And they were making carbon brushes for rotating electrical equipment, and then later got into big carbon and synthetic graphite for electric steel manufacturing. So those were the original businesses of carbide. And the chemical business was really spawned by research done at the with the funding of Union Carbide at the Mellon Institute in Pittsburgh. And started with the work on acetylene. And during the First World War, when the Europeans or the Germans had introduced the use of poison gases, one route to mustard gas, I believe, was starting with acetylene as the base material. And the government asked Union Carbide, who were the foremost manufacturers of acetylene. Acetylene at that time not only was a cutting gas, but was used in automobile and miners' lamps and automobile headlights, the old Prestolite headlamps. And the government asked Carbide to do some work on acetylene chemistry and to prepare some defenses against the poison gases being used by the Germans. That work never produced anything during the war effort, but it did lead to the synthesis of ethylene. Up until then, ethylene had only been produced by reduction from alcohol, ethyl alcohol, and it had never been synthesized from a gas base. And the early carbide scientists, George Kerm, being the leader of the group, C-U-R-M-E, began work to strip ethane out of natural gas and convert ethane, crack it into to ethylene. It was a very crude process, and but it began to look interesting. And with that, the work moved from the Mellon Institute on a contract basis, although Carbide maintained a lab there for a long time, to a small plant in Clendenin, West Virginia. And West Virginia, because it was the closest place to Pittsburgh that had natural gas that had a fairly high content of ethane. So the first gas stripper was built in Clendenin, came off of a natural gas pipeline, and to synthesize ethylene. And I believe I'm correct, at least all of our history books say, that was really the first commercial synthesis of ethylene in North America. And that led to then ethylene oxide, which is a very, very difficult material to handle, and the hydration of that to ethylene glycol, and a whole series of derivatives of the oxide glycol molecule. There was and that went through the 20s, and the early reports of Carbide technical people and historians who set down this work through the 20s and the early 30s was an incredible and rich proliferation of a whole new chemical family. The esters and the ethers and the glycol ethers, for example, and that found their way into paints and solvents and coatings. And I don't think that that early Union Carbide ever knew there was a depression in the early 30s. They just kept inventing so much stuff. And the plant in Clendenin became a plant in Charleston and South Charleston, West Virginia, and to another plant at Institute, West Virginia. That was the beginning of it. And then the move southwest to more abundant sources of the natural gas and ethane and propane. Synthetic ethanol came along in the late 20s, and curiously, in the middle of Prohibition, it was popularly used in for medical purposes and also for automobile de-icer. When you put in your coolant system,
The antifreeze.
Antifreeze. The first ones were ethanol, and of course that would boil off. And but during Prohibition, we were the largest producers of synthetic ethanol, and that is ethylene based, and rather than corn based or sugar based. And we had government inspectors in our plants just because of the Prohibition thing, just to check every gallon that was made and to certify that it was going into purposes for which it was legally allowed. And then came the quick transformation to the use of glycol as an antifreeze, and that was the beginning of the Prestone business. But literally, the proliferation of new chemistry in the late 20s and right through the 30s was most impressive. And there wasn't it probably happened to Carbide in a business sense, in a commercial sense, in a very unorganized way, because there wasn't a molecule that Carbide wasn't in at some time. The styrenes, for example, which were no longer in, and through the acquisition of Baekeland's company and invention in 19, I think the acquisition happened about 1927. That brought in the whole phenolic chemistry work and the bakelite materials, and the plant and the research laboratories in Donbrook, New Jersey, were an important part of that. And that got lashed up. It never lashed up the polymer chemists in Donbrook and the chemical chemists in South Charleston. They never made a good connection. And interestingly, when the synthesis of the long chain polymers the long chain polymers and the manufacture of polyethylene began to look interesting. Carbide didn't have in its chemical research area or in its polymer research area in plastics as they were known then, and the thermosets and the phenolics and epoxy. Carbide didn't have in those areas the kind of expertise that could build, or the kind of process engineering that could build high pressure reactors for handling ethylene as a gas under very, very, very difficult conditions. So they reached out to the gases division, the Linde air separation people, who were building air separation plants in their technical center in Tonawanda, New York, and had some brilliant scientists themselves, process chemistry people, compression people, gas handling people, air separations people, and they brought those people into South Charleston and said, help us build something that will make polyethylene. And they did that. And in fact, the first pilot plant work was done in Tonawanda, New York. And this then was the beginning of Carbide's venture and really this country's venture into a polyethylene using the high pressure process and the Ziegler catalyst at that time.
Where were you in the company management when that?
Oh, that was before. I was still in knee pants. That was in the early 40s.
Okay.
And during the Second World War, the part of the Lend-Lease program, it's little known, when President Roosevelt got Congress to send destroyers and vessels and tanks and whatnot to the UK. There was not a hell of a lot that the UK could pay us back with, except IOUs, but there was some very interesting technology exchange agreements. And ICI, the British chemical company, were ahead of us in the synthesis of polyethylene, in the both in the catalysis and in the process chemistry. And they gave to the United States their rights and their know-how in the technology, and that went and was shared by DuPont and Carbide. And the great need for polyethylene was to replace rubber for jacketing of electrical wire and cable and communications, particularly. Anything was anywhere that you weren't using the wonderful abrasion resistant characteristics of natural rubber. And by the end of the war, the polyethylene business was very interesting. Had permanently indicated that its ability to replace natural rubber and other natural substances in a wide variety of applications, but wire and cable notably. And Carbide and DuPont literally shared the market about 50% each. the polypropylene came along a little bit after that. The styrene came along a little bit after that. Carbide was early in silicones, and again they relied on technologists from the Linde Air Products division to who developed the silicone chemistry, and then it was transferred over into the chemical side of Carbide. And I guess life went on in a pretty good way for Carbide. Up until about the time of the oil shock, the first oil shock in 73. And when oil was less than $2 a barrel, and in 73, I think it was still around $2 a barrel, the raw material world was not a problem. And the ability to synthesize and the proliferation of new molecules and new process chemistry just seemed like there was no end to how good the world of chemistry was going to be. The oil shock caused in 73-4 and then again in 78 major change in the chemical industry, in the petrochemical industry as we know it. For the first time, some of the major oil companies, Exxon notably, had been pretty aggressive in developing their financing and developing their petrochemical business. And Exxon were the first ones to kind of organizationally recognize it by setting chemicals up as quite a separate arm of the oil company and moving them out of headquarters and giving them their own field to play in. For most of the others, chemicals was just kind of a byproduct. The petrochemicals was just a sort of byproduct business. wasn't a major game to play. With the change in the flow of oil from the Middle East and the organization of that. When the Arab countries took over the control of the price of oil at the wellhead, and Aramco changed totally from what it had been, the oil companies began to look at other areas for major investment and growth, and came into petrochemicals in a big way. This changed the world for Carbide and others. DuPont, maybe not so much because they were both bigger than Carbide, and and much broader in non-petrochemical areas. They were big in petrochemicals as well, but Dow were somewhat less affected probably because they had a big stake in inorganic and again more diversity. But it changed the world for carbide, and growth slowed down. The proliferation of competitors turned the ethylene and ethylene chain businesses largely into fundamental commodity businesses and very cyclical. And at the same time, all of carbide's other diverse businesses, the old conglomerate of consumer products, by this time Eveready and Prestone and Glad Wrap were big consumer names, and the market was confused about Union Carbide. They didn't know whether we're a consumer company or ferroalloy metals industry company or what. So this was a tough period in sorting out what we were really good at. Fortunately, the inventory of technology leadership, particularly in process technology, we pretty much I think stopped inventing new molecules somewhere between the 50s and the 60s, and our expertise turned more to process chemistry and process innovation, being able to scale up, manufacture to a large and very low cost processes, new catalyst development. This became sort of the reservoir on which carbide fell back and really has been the springboard for the success of carbide in the last 10 years. Has been the process technology and the catalysis.
You were certainly involved in the management during that transition
mm-hmm.
period.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that there was a change in corporate management style to accompany the change in the emphasis on production?
Well, there was. There were a lot of contributing factors, exogenous factors, external factors, pressures. The gas release and tragedy in Bhopal, coming after the oil shocks. I'm not comparing these in any way, except they were both. Both really extremely important and somewhat tragic events in the history of this corporation. And because Bhopal, which happened in December of 1984, came at a time when the corporation was kind of in disarray. Petrochemical business had been in a prolonged slump and great overcapacity in the industry, and nobody was making any money. The metals related businesses were not doing well at all. The only stars in the corporation were really the consumer products businesses, the Eveready, and they were much more resistant to movements in the business cycle, and they were kind of glamour businesses. Consumer products had a lot of glitz and glamour at that time, and the publicity the litigation, the uncertainty created by the tragedy in Bhopal, and the terrible effect it had on the morale of the people of Karbite all over the world. And the shares of Union Carbide, even before Bhopal, were only selling at 70% of the book value of the corporation, which reflected this kind of business turmoil and the results of the energy crises and so forth. Well, after Bhopal, the stock went down by about half. So now it's about 35 or 40% of book value. And this happened in a period, you remember the 80s was the period of lots of corporate takeover activity and junk bonds and Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky and the barbarians at the gate kind of mentality. A lot of financial jiggery pokery was going on, and so sure enough, within a few months after Bhopal, speculators began to buy in Carbide stock, irrespective of the unknown litigation and settlement costs of this tragedy in India. The stock was too good a bargain, and people could see the intrinsic value of some of these businesses was pretty high. And so that led almost a year to the day after the gas release in Bhopal. It led to an announced takeover attempt by a much smaller chemical company, GAF, who said that their purpose was to to borrow enough money to acquire Carbide on the strength of the assets of Carbide, and that if they were successful, they would break Carbide up, and they would sell off the family jewels, the consumer businesses, which were easy to sell off, and they'd sell off some of the other good things. And when they're all done selling it off and paying back their debt, they would have retained the chemical business for nothing, for free. It was a pretty good scheme. And the great uncertainty was the unknown liability of the aftermath of Bhopal. So we did what most managements did at that time, and we got into a bidding war for our own shares. And we said, if this guy's going to buy our shares, we'll buy him back too, and we'll just have to outbid him. And he lost heart at a certain level, and we agreed to buy back our own shares, which meant we had to go to the banks and borrow a hell of a lot of money. And essentially, we had to do at least part of what he said he was going to do, that is, to pay off his debt, we had to sell off the family jewels. And that, with you can imagine, the if morale was bad after Bhopal, it was bad, even worse, after an unfriendly, hostile takeover attempt, which left us saddled with about $5.5 billion worth of debt, and a very high-priced debt. The junk bond debt was... We had three series of junk bonds. One was 15.5%, one was 16.5%, and the other was 17.5% interest rate. It was awful. And the covenants on the debt didn't permit us to really turn around and do anything without the permission of the lenders. We couldn't acquire anything, we couldn't sell anything, we couldn't reorganize anything. So that was about the low point at the end of the end of the takeover attempt and the sale of the businesses. And of course,
where were you in the management at that?
I was president of the corporation then, and the chairman, Warren Anderson, who was a great heroic man. He was chairman and CEO at the time of the Bhopal release, and he was 2 years away from retirement. And he was chairman through the hostile takeover attempt, and then he was 1 year away from retirement. And in the natural course of things, I had been appointed president about 6 months after Bhopal. And And then after the takeover attempt, about 6 months later, the board announced that Warren was going to retire at normal retirement age at the end of that year, and that I would take over as CEO during the year, and I would become chairman then after he retired. So it all went very rapidly, and when you're forced to sell off businesses in a circumstance like that, with a gun to your head, it's a messy. You don't get the best bargain. You just go out and get it done under a time deadline. And so there are lots of pieces and bits of the remainder of carbide still around. The gases business and the carbon business and the ferroalloy business and the silicones business and some other electronics things and so forth that we've dabbled in. So we still had about 10 principal businesses, even after consumer products was gone, and a lot of debt, and lousy morale, and it was really time to take stock of, you know, what can you salvage out of this? That was really the issue. And when I would talk to security analysts or the press or anybody, newly hired engineers and people, the question that people typically like to ask is, what's this corporation going to look like in 5 years? You've just become CEO in 1986, and where do you want to take this? I mean, obvious questions. Well, I didn't have the foggiest damn idea. We'd just gotten over the worst kind of shocks, and had not gotten over them. We'd just gone through this and trying to catch our breath and bloody and battered. So I had no vision. I said some words. Usually what I said was, well, I've worked in all the businesses of carbide, and I really believe that we had some great businesses. I knew the products, I knew the technology, I knew the markets, I knew the customers, and it didn't work as a conglomerate, but I did believe we had some great businesses, and either very large market share or low cost position or best technology for producing something, so it took a while, and we had in. We had some good luck in, I took over in 86, and we had some good luck in 88 and 89 because the chemical industry went through really what was kind of an all-time peak. Supply and demand came close together for the first time in about 10 years, and prices shot up, and if you were dumb and blind, you could make money in 88 and 89, and we made a ton, and that took the pressure off. We did some refinancing, got rid of all of that high cost debt, paid down a lot of debt, caught our breath, put some more money into physical plant and facilities, and probably we got a little bit euphoric, and we thought, well, it'll never end. Now we're back on the right side, and that was not correct, because by 1990 the bloom had come off the rose again in chemical margins, and profits were way down again, and we were back to examining the need for a restructure of the corporation and re-engineering. And I told the board in 89 that I wasn't at all sure that it made sense to keep unrelated businesses together in the same portfolio, that they were all very capital intensive, and the job of top management for many years in carbide had been to kind of sort out the loaves and the fishes between all of the hungry businesses that wanted a lot of capital and you didn't have enough. So you'd kind of parse out the scarce resources and using what we thought were very sophisticated strategic planning and measurements. I had become convinced that the market was a better allocator of capital than corporate management, because no matter how sophisticated our investment criteria and our investment analyses would be, you were always subject to being importuned by the last guy who got to the chairman with his pet project and got the chairman's ear about what a great deal this was. And because the business were strategically quite unrelated. So I got the board and the corporation prepared in terms of tax implications and organization for a separation of the businesses into independent companies, publicly traded companies. And I said, let the chemicals guys focus on what they can really do best. And they've got to compete in capital markets. They've got to compete for shareholder attention. Let the gases guys go out and compete with BOC and British Oxygen and Air Liquide and in their own field and so forth. So we kind of, and as we were doing this, we went through massive re-engineering and restructuring program. And it was very effective. We took more than a third of the fixed cost, of the total fixed cost of the corporation out. In 1990, our fixed costs were $1.7 billion. We took about $600 million of fixed costs out in the same measurement of dollars, cost of dollars. And we did it by getting rid of work, by just looking at every work process that went on in the corporation, and saying to ourselves, why are we taking so many steps in such a long time to do this? How can we simplify the work? Because you can make people go away, but if you don't make the work go away, the people come back. So you've got to get rid of work. And we were coming from way back. Our productivity was the lowest in the industry. We were a very fat organization. There was a tremendous reduction in levels of organization. Went from, I suppose when I took over, there probably between me and the guy on the shop floor or the field salesperson, there probably 12 or 13 layers. I think we're down about 7. And communications improved. We spent a lot of time internally talking about what we were trying to do, spelling out a vision. You got sick of your own voice talking over and over and over again to people because you couldn't tell them once. You had to repeat it and demonstrate it and live it, and then you had to show them some results. Our people have been through some bloody much tragedy. They were skeptical that that there was anything, any ice cream at the end of the day. So it worked out pretty well. The stock of all of those companies, the aggregate value of that has gone up about tenfold since 1990, and the businesses are doing very well. Even though they're not part of Carbide, the chemical business is doing very well, and we're back to innovation for growth, new process technology, and all kinds of exciting things.
It was obviously a happy decision you made to stay with the company, but I've learned from some published material that shortly after the Bhopal tragedy, you had offers for executive opportunities elsewhere, and some management personnel in Carbide took opportunities to move. What was it that kept you at Carbide?
Well, I personally, I never had an offer.
I was
never even approached.
That's contrary to what's published, but...
In 41 years with the corporation, I only... One time did I think about writing a resume and seeing if I could find another job, and that was back in the late '60s. And I mentioned that I had been traveling overseas extensively for 3 or 4 years, and I was just, I was pooped, and they were running my tail off, and I was a little bit unhappy with some of the organization things that were going on. And so I wrote a resume, and I put it out, and I found out I wasn't in great demand. and before anything happened, and I told my bosses that I was right up front with them. I said I'm unhappy. And before anything happened, they came and said, "How would you like to move to Geneva, Switzerland?" I said, "Right now." They said, "Don't you want to go home and talk to your wife?" I said, "No, I'm ready to go. We've talked about it and hoped for it, and I'll go right now." And I went to Europe and stayed for 7 years. And no, I was just very lucky, Jim. After Bhopal, Warren Anderson came and made me president of over all the chemicals 6 months after Bhopal, and I really figured that it was a great opportunity. I loved the people and I was pretty familiar with the history, and I figured it can't get any worse. I mean, what else could happen? We had Bhopal, we had the takeover attempt, and so if you can't go any lower, then it's not a bad time to become the leader if you think you can only get better. And it took a long time. I was CEO for 10 years, but it got better.
Take two of the interview with Robert D. Kennedy.
One of the things that to give some substance to my comments about the process technology and the innovation of carbide, and every chemical company that's been around for any time has wonderful stories to tell about the scientific developments and the business developments of their company. If you go back over the history of the chemical industry, look at the for example at the top industry recognition. The Kirkpatrick Awards, the Perkin Medal, I think the Perkin Medal first started, the SCI first started awarding the Perkin Medal in the 1890s sometime. I believe I'm correct in saying that there are more carbide people among Perkin Medal winners than any other corporation in America. And interestingly, in the early days of the Perkin Medal, a lot of it, as you might imagine, was electrochemistry or metallurgy. Edward G. Acheson, who was the inventor of synthetic graphite and then later on carborundum, was a Perkin winner about 1912, and his Acheson Graphite Company became a part of the National Carbon Company of carbide. Leo Baekeland, the Belgian who developed Bakelite and the phenolics,
There was a guy whose name I've forgotten, in the middle 20s, who got a Perkin Medal, and his development was really an alloy for during the First World War, an alloy that was used in tanks for to repel armor-piercing shells. And so there was a lot of that in the early days. Then it got into more into chemistry and polymer chemistry, catalysis. Fred Carroll, who I think Fred just retired, was recognized for his work in polyethylene and in the development of the low pressure process for making polyethylene, the so-called Unipol process. Edie Flanagan was the latest winner, and she was the first female to win the Perkin Medal. And Edie got the medal for her work in molecular sieves and both for adsorbent and catalysis. The Kirkpatrick Award. Somebody added up how many Kirkpatrick Awards we've received, and I think it's the highest in the industry. And most of it has been, well, I was going to say most of it's been on process technology, but that's not quite right. But the commercialization it's been wonderful for me to, as a mechanical engineer, to just develop and enhance my appreciation of what chemists and chemical engineers have been able to do. Really quite remarkable.
The gas release at Bhopal occurred just shortly before you became CEO.
Right.
Did you have a sense that you were able to bring about a settlement because your attitude about the appropriate response from carbide was significantly different from that of your predecessor?
No, not at all. My predecessor from the minute that he flew to Bhopal right after the news came through to try to meet with government officials and local people to try to do anything that was possible to help. And when he arrived there, he flew over by himself. And he was met in Bombay by the Indian chairman and the Indian managing director of the company. And then they went on from Bombay to Bhopal by plane. And the Indian local officials met them at the plane and then held them under house arrest for 3 or 4 days. And then expelled them from the country. They were never allowed to talk with anybody, and no anybody at any rank in government. So the purpose of the trip was frustrated, and because the politicalization of the tragedy just took place in 24 hours. The uproar from the Indian press particularly from the far left, about the multinational exploiters of the people. So when he got out there, he was sort of an embarrassment to the government. How do you deal with a man who comes with his heart on his sleeve and says, "I want to help"? If they met with him, they would have been accused of collaborating with the enemy. So it was a terrible thing, and Warren came back from that badly abused and shook up, and at a press conference here in at the Hilton in the ballroom, there must have been 150 people there. I was there, and Warren said in response to a question from the audience, "We accept full moral responsibility for what happened in India." And that was just a spontaneous statement of the man. And he spent the next 2 years doing everything he possibly could to find a way to reach a settlement. Early on, there were lawsuits brought in federal court in New York, or they're brought all over the United States, but they're consolidated in Southern District Court in New York. And Judge Keenan knew that he was kind of sitting on a kind of a landmark deal, and he wanted to forge be the instrument for forging a settlement, for showing that the kind of a global tort, worldwide damage thing could be quickly resolved, and we wanted to resolve it. Our board wanted to resolve it. They wanted to get it done and behind them. There were 100 plaintiff's attorneys, because the plaintiff's attorneys went from the United States out to India and signed people up on the street corners out there. The government of India retained its own attorneys, a law firm in Minneapolis. So there were 100 attorneys plus the government of India. And the government of India, within a month or so of the release, by decree and then finally by act of parliament, the government of India saw all those American lawyers running around and thought that was chaotic. So the government appointed themselves, the government, the sole representative of the people of Bhopal and the sole remedy, and they wanted to take all the other lawyering out. So now in district court we had the government of India and the judge finally got all the plaintiff's attorneys to appoint a committee of three who would represent the 100. And they were very, very close to a settlement, negotiated settlement. And somebody, we think maybe it was the lawyers for the government of India, leaked the settlement to the New York Times. And this is about April, 5 months after the deal. And the New York Times printed it up on a Sunday morning. And it really blew the settlement out of water. It gave all the opponents a chance to get in and muck it up before the final terms had been agreed to and worked out. And that sent him back to square one. And poor old Warren, he said to me and another guy, "You guys run the corporation. You run the corporation. I'm going to do everything I can to get this settled before I retire." So it turned out it was so political that it was impossible of settlement until such time as the Indian government wanted to settle. At one point, we had retained a number of consultants to help us. And we were even thinking of trying to appoint an international tribunal of well-respected world leaders who would sit as a panel, and with the agreement of the Indian government and ourselves, they would do some fact finding and they would recommend a settlement. And I went to London to visit Lord Callaghan, former Prime Minister of the UK, Labour Party guy, and And because he was a guy that we thought might be a member of this tribunal. And I went to sound him out on it and get his advice. He was well thought of in India. He had been an ambassador to India some in his career. And he gave me some great advice. He said, look, Mr. Kennedy, we talked for a couple of hours. He said, look, two points I would make to you. He said, the Indian government knows that you are not unreasonable people. Your chairman flew to India at great personal risk to himself immediately after the tragedy and exposed himself and tried to do the right thing with great honor to himself and with great honor to your corporation, and he was rebuffed. And you have been trying all these different routes. You've gone through the embassies, you've gone through other... Rajiv Gandhi was then Prime Minister in India, and you've all kinds of feelers out, and you've been willing to meet with anybody anywhere to try to resolve this issue. He said, it will not be resolved until the Indian government believes that the moment is right. It is so politicized, that it just won't happen. And they know that any time... You had money on the table. You had a lot of money on the table. And they know that any time they want to step up and take the money, it'll happen. So you can't make it happen. My other advice to you is do not try artificially to make it happen. Do not listen to people who come to you and say, if you'll only spend some money on public relations in India, or if you'll only... do this or do that, I know somebody who knows somebody who's right next to Rajiv, and if it doesn't come through official cycles, if it doesn't come through somebody in government, don't get involved. Do not monkey with the internal politics of India. You'll just get creamed. And that was sort of what our inclination was anyway, and we could have had better advice. So we went back and we just waited. And in 1988 now, this is 4 years, 4 years after the gas emission. During that time, we tried through third parties to set up aid stations. We financed. We gave a lot of money to the International Red Cross. The Indian Red Cross wouldn't take it, so the money sat in Switzerland. University of Arizona, Arizona State University, came to us and said they had an idea for setting up a rehabilitation center to rehab people and to retrain people and get them back to work, whether they were victims or just people of Bhopal. And we financed that, and then the government of India found out that our money was behind it, and they came in literally with bulldozers and took it out. So we were really frustrated. And in December of 88, I got a call from an American who had been on an official kind of a business trip to India, and he had met with three ministers of the government and finally with the Prime Minister himself. And they called him in and they said, do you know this fella Kennedy? He said, yeah, I know. So would you be willing to carry a message to him? He said, sure. He said, the message is that if they're still willing to settle for the amount of money that was on the table in 1986 or 85 and add a little interest because now it's 1988, we think we can get the Supreme Court to order the settlement. The Supreme Court will take the hot seat. It will not be the government. It will be the Supreme Court, which is highly respected. We'll order the government and Union Carbide to make this settlement. And there had never been any hearings in court. Never were. There haven't been yet. But the court would just, a panel of the court would just take this on and order a settlement for the relief of the victims. And this guy came back from his trip in November of 88, and he called me. And I said, sure. So he got word back, and by golly, 3 months later, February of 89, it was settled. And it was independent of me. It was independent of Warren Anderson. It was just a question of when the government felt they could take the political heat. And meanwhile, that quashed all civil action as vis-a-vis, since the government had already made itself the official representative of the people and the remedy for the people. We paid the check to the government. The government was then going to take and distribute the funds. They haven't really done that. They have given out to the people no more than what would constitute the interest earned on the $600 million settlement. The corruption is so bad. That's a long answer to your question.
Very interesting answer. The Bhopal tragedy had a profound impact on Union Carbide, but also, I believe, it affected the entire chemical industry in making them more attentive to environmental concerns, perhaps.
Absolutely did.
You were involved in that extension.
The realization that the unthinkable could happen, and it could happen anywhere. Well, I was at that time, I was Union Carbide's representative as president of the corporation. I was Union Carbide's representative to the board of directors of the Chemical Manufacturers Association, which embraces everybody in the country who makes chemicals. And the leaders of the board at that time were George Sella of Cyanamid and Ed Homer, I think, of Exxon, and Bob Rowland, who was the full-time executive president. And they came up here to this building within a week or so after. Well, it was a week or so after Warren had gotten back from his trip to India. And Warren asked me to sit in on the discussion. And they all had known Warren a long time, and they were good friends. And they said, Warren, what can we do to help? And because everybody just feels terrible about this, and we need to know where you are and what you're doing and what we can do to help, because it hits the whole goddamn chemical industry. What happened to you could have happened to any one of us. Warren had gotten calls from his friends among the major European chemical producers in Germany and in England, with the same kind of expression of sympathy and offer to help. There wasn't a hell of a lot they could do, but they did ask Warren to come down to A regularly scheduled meeting of the board of CMA was the following month in January. And they asked Warren if he would come to that meeting and get up and speak to the entire group. This is about 45 CEOs. About Bhopal, about what he knew about it, what his expectations were, and so forth. Warren did that. I was there. It must have been a horrendous experience for him. But he was the kind of a man who was always great on his feet, and he was very good extemporaneously. He was a very natural person, big, tall, athletic guy. He'd been the captain of the football team in college and all that. And a soft-spoken man, a man of some humor, gentle humor. At that same meeting, the working committees of the Chemical Manufacturers Association said, we've got to come up with a response, a proactive response. And the most obvious area was that of community awareness and emergency response. What do you do in the face of such a tragedy? What do you do even before the potential for such a tragedy? What do you do to make the neighbors around a chemical plant aware of what's going on and what you're doing every day to ensure their safety and to control emissions, just normal fugitive emissions, whatever, spills? So the industry immediately adopted and set in place a committee to flesh out what was called a CARE program, C-A-E-R, Community Awareness and Emergency Response. And that went like lightning. Everybody, there was a bill of particulars and a set of management practices that should be put in place, that around every plant in the country you should set up some kind of a liaison, a formal working relationship with first responders. They should be trained alongside of your own people. You should get into anticipatory programs in communities, so that people, we could no longer take the view that what went on inside our gates was our business, nobody else's business. Put aside this old argument about proprietary information, and you can't tell the neighbors because you might tell their competitors, and that's a lot of BS anyway, and let's get down to it, guy. The program was an instant success, and so much so that the United Nations environmental protection people, hearing about it, asked if they couldn't take it and replicate it. And we even seconded a retiring American chemical executive to go to the UNEP headquarters in Paris and work on this for a couple of years, and it went around the world. In the meantime, in 85, right, the year after Bhopal, the Canadian chemical industry, CCPA, Canadian Chemical Producers Association, went even further than CARE, and they adopted a 6 or 8 point program of what they call responsible care that was going to deal not only with community awareness, but it was going to deal with emission reduction, product stewardship from cradle to grave, and transportation of products, and they got going with a pretty good head of steam up in Canada, and it looked pretty good. And I had heard about it from our Canadian subsidiary, who was quite active in the establishment of this thing. And by that time, I was on a part of a committee. I sub-chaired a committee, I guess, that Paul Orfis of Dow headed on the board committee on public perception. What are we going to do post-Bhopal to deal with this public perception issue? And the PR won't do it. We got to do some substantial things. So my committee was looking around for what to do, and we glommed onto this Canadian program and brought the Canadians down, met with them right here in this conference room, and spent a half a day going over their program. Their program had a lot of substance to it. It had a set of 10 principles of responsible care that you would agree to, you would sign on to as a company, and it developed then 6 management practice codes that really dealt with everything you did with chemicals from development in the laboratory to their ultimate disposal by the final consumer, included a version of self-assessment, which is now going into third-party auditing today. And as part of my committee responsibility, I introduced this into CMA, and at the time, in a most curious way, I was going through the chairs of CMA. So I kind of, I had a dual responsibility. I'd gotten onto this responsible care thing through discussion with the Canadians, and then I was also going through the chairs of CMA, so I had a great opportunity to see that it got put in, and there's a long period of education of talking to all of the membership. We felt that we in order to be effective, we had to make a sign-on to the Responsible Care Initiative, a condition of membership in the Chemical Manufacturers Association. If you were going to be a member, you had to sign on to this. And you had to then validate and report on your practices on an annual basis. And it's taken over. It's taken hold in a remarkable way. And it's now expanded to 36 countries around the world. 36 was the last count I had. Have adopted responsible care. It has done a great deal to, at first, there were a lot of skeptics, you can imagine, and there still are. But it's done an enormous amount to stop the increasingly negative ratings in public opinion polls of the chemical industry. And in working with government agencies and so forth, it's started us back up again, and they see that we're actually doing something that's worthwhile. So that's been a tremendous positive out of this whole Bhopal thing. It's not just Bhopal and Seveso and the Rhine River and the Exxon Valdez and all of those things. Those high, and they got such a high. And industry performance is better. If you look at the reports, the official reports on SARA Title III, everybody has to report annually on their emissions. Those numbers are going down and down and down and down. We track since 85, since I became president of Carbide. I set up a system whereby I wanted a report on every emission and spill that we had anywhere in the world, I wanted to report in 24 hours. If it was anything that would get us into the public domain or local press, or a serious accident or a fatality or a fire, and when we start tracking those, how many calls and how many emissions and spills. I don't know whether to wish it was a spill or whether to wish it was somebody got injured. I mean, it's going to be one or the other. What the hell do I look for when I pick up the phone? And
you didn't consider an unlisted number?
No, well, I have an unlisted number, but all of our people had my. I told them to call me. I said, because I figure it would get people's attention if they've got to call the president of the company and say, we've just had a chlorine leak and an ammonia leak and Charleston, West Virginia, and there's a little cloud, just not a big cloud, but a little cloud is floating out over the plant. Boy, I'll tell you, it got their attention, mm-hmm. and got my attention. So,
well, this remarkable career you've had led in 1995 to your receiving the Society of Chemical Industry Medal.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me something about your reaction to that event.
Well, it was, it's an incredible honor. I'd been going to those dinners for 15 years at the Plaza where those awards are made, the black tie dinners, and I think this is a very serious award. And I so respect the people who have who had been honored before and after me. And so I was just overwhelmed with the whole thing. I'm just very grateful. The industry had been very kind to me. I started to say earlier, that about the time we were getting into responsible care, I was working through the chairs of the Chemical Manufacturers Association. And that's a four-year rotation. You start out as chairman of the finance committee, and then you become vice chairman of the executive committee, and then chairman of the executive committee, and then finally chairman. And I got a call. This is about 6 months after Bhopal, when I'd been named president of Carbide, and I had already been sitting on the CMA board, and I got a call from the president of CMA, and he said, Bob, the nominating committee wants to put your name in as vice chairman of the finance committee, and that would start you through the chairs. And I'm calling because it's a kind of a four-year commitment, and I'm calling to ask if you would be willing to do that. And I said, wait a minute now. You're calling, this is May or June of, no, it was May before the annual meeting, May of 1985. You're calling to see if the president of the Bhopal Company would go through the chairs and I would wind up being a spokesperson for the chemical industry? He said, that's right. I said, are you quite sure that's what you want to do? He said, that's what we want to do. So I said, well, I got to talk to my bosses and, you know, for all I know, they may be going to transfer me into someplace else or fire me. So let me go talk to them. And I went and talked to Warren and Al Flam, who was our vice chairman at the time. I said, I can't believe this. These guys want me to go through the chairs. And that is profound. And it it's the greatest thing that could happen to Union Carbide, that they would be willing to take a risk like that with us. So if you guys don't object, I said, I think I'd like to do that. I think I ought to do that. And I still can't get over that. To this day, Jim, and in doing that, that's what put me in the time and place and position that I would be honored by this Chemical Industry Board.
Well, during your career, you have expressed your interest in management affairs outside the company by being involved in several education boards. What first prompted you to undertake that kind of off-site responsibility?
Well, I've always been interested in education. And I was on the board of the International School in Geneva when we were there for 6 years. And
were your children in the school?
Yeah, our kids were in the school, and I got on the board of governors. It's a very international school. They had 65 different nationalities in that school. And then I came back, and I got involved in the board of trustees of the boarding school that I went to in New England, and then I got involved. When President Bush convened the governors in Charlottesville in 1989 and said that he wanted to be the education president and he wanted to come out with a program that ultimately was called the Goals 2000 to make American public education tops. And he challenged the Business Roundtable, which is about 200 CEOs, and asked them what they were prepared to do to help in his Goals 2000. And I joined the Roundtable Education Committee. Johnny Akers of IBM headed at the time. I joined that committee and we went to see the president at the White House the day before the conference of the governors that he was going to attend at Charlottesville. And we said, Mr. President, if you and the governors will set a goal that America will be tops in education, public education, by the year 2000, and if you'll set up some mechanism for knowing how we got there, by what standard would you say that we are at the top of the ladder? And then education is a state-by-state deal. It's administered by the state. So then we will undertake to work and set up a business coalition in every state in the country and work with the governors and their chosen aides to forge a business education coalition for systemic school reform. And the governors did largely what Bush asked, and then the Clinton administration reaffirmed it pretty much. They changed the names a little bit, and we set about doing our part, and I came back and initiated a Connecticut Business Education Coalition. I had about 35 CEOs we convened in Connecticut. This is in 1990, and addressing ourselves to reform of public education statewide. Systemic reform. We're going to deal with early childhood, setting high standards for all kids in all schools, teacher development and staff development work, introduction of technology, and introduction of a better system of accountability. If schools are failing, let's figure out a way to get rid of whoever is administering those and take them over. And we can't let schools fail. So we had a pretty good thing going in Connecticut. And Lowell Weicker was governor then, and he took up the cause and gave his entire State of the State message in about 1992 to education reform. the legislature then set up a Blue Ribbon Commission to advise and to come up with a bill on comprehensive reform. And they packed the commission with 11 business guys, 11 guys from our coalition. I was one of them. And a business guy was co-chair, a guy who just retired from Surface Combustion. And that was my involvement, and I'm still kind of involved. Now I'm retired. I teach. I guest professor at business schools. I do a week every semester up at the Cornell Business School. I do, you know, five days of seminar sessions a couple times a day with graduate students in business. And I'm doing one next week at the University of Massachusetts. I just have fun with it. I talk about everything. I talk about Bhopal. I talk about crisis management. I talk about integrity. I'll tell you, when you have a gas release or a major explosion and people are killed, and you start looking at how to pick yourself up, and you realize that the only thing you ever had going for you to begin with was reputation. And when that's down the drain, the only way you get back is one day at a time. And that's the hard way to learn that lesson. I'm going to have to...
Just ask one more question, okay, if I may. You've been so busy with Union Carbide mm-hmm. affairs. It's remarkable that you've had time for family affairs, but according to your biographical mm-hmm. information, you do have a family.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me briefly about that?
Yeah, we have four kids. Sally and I just celebrated our 41st wedding anniversary. Kids are all grown up, of course. Our baby is 26, and she's going to be married in May. But they're all relatively normal and straight and doing good. We have four grandchildren, four little girls, grandchildren.
Any of your children in the chemical industry world?
No. Two boys were not technical, and they're both in business and marketing and sales. And our older daughter is in social work, very much a giver. She was running a family group center down in Maryland and to help single parents not only take care of children, but to get them educated enough to go into the workforce. And it's a state agency that she runs. And our youngest, who is about to be married, is in graduate school to get a master's degree in special education down in Virginia. And she'll be back into teaching in special ed.
Thank you for being so generous with your time. I know you have an appointment. And very good talking with you.
Thank you a lot, Jim.